Pseudopod episode 173, December 18th, 2009. This week's story, Bafata Tswana by Levi Tida. Welcome to Pseudopod, the weekly horror podcast. I'm your host, and this week's story comes to us from Levi Tida. Levi is the author of the superb linked story collection Hebrew Punk, the novella An Occupation of Angels, the other novellas Cloud Permutations and Gorel and the Potbellied God, and with Nir Yaniv, the Tel Aviv Dossier. He's lived on three continents, one island nation, and currently lives in Southeast Asia. His first novel, The Bookman, will be published by Angry Robot in spring 2010. Incidentally, if you've not picked up Slight, Moxieland, Necropolis, Book of Secrets, Triumph, or pretty much anything else from Angry Robot, do so. One of the most consistent and consistently interesting imprints in years. Also, you should know this story has a fair chunk of Afrikaans slang in it. There's a primer on the website which we'd recommend you check out before listening. It'll help. Your narrator this week is Alan Ressel of Voices.com. So get ready for a night on the streets of Bafata Tswana, because I have a story for you.
Bafata Tswana by Levi Tida. Late at night, in Melville, we picked out fat honeyed smiles from a jar full of eyes on the low table. An Indian woman, like copper-red coins sitting on the bar. Loose change in Melville. And the cries of the Rasta men, selling dried-out love, on the street outside where it is warm. Perfumed cars sashaying down the parade of bars. Cows in pasture. And besides Wesley and me, a beautiful fat black woman smokes a cigarette in tender puffs. Her breath steams up. Apartheid night, when it rained and the colors all ran together. We're driving down Rivonia with the Santon Towers rising on our left, illuminated in neon light like metal spikes driven into a crossroads. Wes is driving. I'm sitting in the passenger seat rolling a spliff under the dashboard. Wes is on a retro trip. On the old tape deck, Mango Groove's Another Country is replaced by Johnny Clegg and Savuka singing Asimbonanga Mandela. Wes lifts one hand off the steering wheel in a closed-fisted salute. Mandela! I put the rest of the dope back into the banky and seal it, returning it to my coat pocket. I roll the joint quickly, my fingers smoothing the finished cone as if stroking a lover's finger. I put it in my mouth and spark up, and it flares against my mirror shades like a miniature explosion. You know what they call people like us in America, I say. Wes looks at me sideways. His pupils are large, his dark hair falling over a delicate oval face. I don't know, bro, superheroes. No, arsehole, I say. I took a hit on the spliff and pass it to him. The smoke percolates through my lungs and the definition of light outside grows sharper. Wes is Chinese and lives with his mum down near Broomer Lake. His mum's a born-again Christian. He's the color of pine and burnt amber. Beside him, I am Ethiopian mocha, drunk with cream. They call us people of color. Wes takes a toke on the spliff and shakes his head. That's fucked up, bro. The car races down past walled suburban prisons, decorated in barbed wire and electronic alarms, and beware the dog signs. Does that mean white people are called colorless? No, I say. I think they're just called people. Wes nods deeply at that. We share the joint in silence, listening to the changing music, as the car goes past Rosebank Mall's fake fairy tale facade. On the crossroads we stop. A beggar approaches us with a cardboard sign that says, "We'll work for food." Wes rolls down the window and gives him a 1 rand coin. The beggar takes it but doesn't move off. Wes shrugs and hands him the remains of the joint. The beggar takes a deep hit and rocks his head. Dark matted dreadlocks shake like a weeping willow in a storm.
"What's that you're listening to?" he says. "The Springbok Nude Girls."
He suddenly grins and I realize he's not that much older than us. His English has an Afrikaans accent and his skin, for all its pallor, still retains vestiges of a farmer's tan.
"I was at the concert they gave at the Rand Easter show in, what was it, 95, 96. Fucking rocked, man."
He seems to think about it.
"It was slacker," he says.
He looks directly at me now, and his face loses its grin. His eyes are filled with rain clouds.
It's all gone, Brew. You got to stay in the present.
He shakes his head. Shit, for a moment I thought it really was the 90s. He ambles away, muttering to himself. Wes winds up the window, and the light changes, and we're off across Jan Smuts Avenue.
Are you sure we're going to find some there? I say. Melville.
Wes shrugs.
That's what the Sangoma said.
The Sangoma's our third. Her name's Lufuno. She is calm where we are manic, cool where we are inflamed. Her name means love. Our names mean shit. So we're driving to Melville. During the day, it is a genteel, quiet street, where white people sit in Europeanized coffee shops and eat slices of cheesecake and drink espresso and try to ignore the black guys who walk up and down the street trying to sell them factory-produced African curios. There are two second-hand bookshops, run by a German and a Jew, respectively, and lots of bars that remain mostly empty until the evening. During the day, Melville waits, as if Main Street is holding its breath, and the hot air is still in anticipation. Until night falls, and a great lungful of air is released. And the stillness shatters like a mirror breaking to 1,000 tiny glass knives. Wes's fingers drum a beat on the steering wheel. He looks at me and shakes his head and says,
"Never used to see white guys begging on the street. It's freaky, eh?"
"Yeah," I say. "And that Oki was right. Turn that shit off. What is it with you in the fucking 90s anyway?" I hit the button and replace the tape in the deck with a new one, and a bass line begins pounding out of the speakers. Wes rolls down the window and the wind comes tearing into the car with a smell of recent rain, blowing away the stale Dacha smoke. Wes sticks his head out of the window and screams a long, incoherent shout into the night, until an oncoming car returns his scream with its horn, and he withdraws his head from the window and smiles at me, as innocent as a child.
"I was young then," he says simply.
We drive past Greenside and onto Barry Herzog Avenue. On either side of us, the park looks dark and brooding, cloaked in shadows like the billowing robes of a vampire. I say, "We both were," then fall quiet as I think about it. It was a weird time, an end, a beginning. Wes and I hooked up working for an internet company in Randburg. Under apartheid, we were both classified as coloureds, a lot less than whites, a little more than blacks. Being Chinese, Wes was fucked both ways. He couldn't get a job under apartheid for not being white, and he couldn't get a job after apartheid for not being black. With me it was easier. I was a little of this and a little of that, part Jew and part black, like something from Eugene de Blanche's worst nightmares. Now Wes does a little freelance web design from home, and I sell advertising space, and in the nights we fight crime. Sort of. We arrive at last, and Wes parks the car. I think about what lies ahead and tense. Wes notices and says, "Chill, Brew, we'll do it this time." I say, "Let's hit it." We get out of the car and Wes takes the front of the tape deck with him so it can't be stolen. We go to the booth and it opens.
"Ready?"
"Ready." We take out two long knives, their edges serrated, each ending in a point so sharp it could bleed the air. We hide them under our long black coats. We take out a pair of Uzis and make them disappear inside the coats. Wes takes out two pairs of walkie-talkies he picked up at the Broomer flea market a couple of months back. They're cheap, plasticky things, but they work, and I strap mine to my belt, along with 50-round magazines, a couple of grenades, a knuckle duster, and a Saturday night special. Wes carefully slings a small black bag on his shoulder. I adjust my mirror shades. "Then let's do it," I say. And we walk up Main Street towards the bars and the noise and the beckoning lights. I remember the 90s the way I remember Swaziland, as a rocky terrain covered in clouds like a fog. When I was young and romantic, I wrote a poem about Swaziland. Low-lying clouds rest on the Matsapa Hills, precariously balanced in the stillborn morning air, like sleeping elementals. It is a gentle landscape, unevenly divided squares of vegetation, tinged by the syrupy thick fields of sugarcane, and in the distance, a lonely farmhouse, a water reservoir, are the only testimonies to this land's man-made nature. And a few years later I wrote, "These are empty human spaces, a flat and dusty desolation, dotted by mud huts, dusty brick bottle stores, and the only growth industry of this region, funeral parlors. Perception changes suddenly, like an exploding bomb, like the 90s. I remember when I arrived in Johannesburg, I lived with my dad in New York, and he let me go back to be with my mother. He was an African-American who'd been to Africa once and didn't like it. She was a large Jewish woman with a nasal voice and an expensive car. I arrived at Jan Smuts Airport and the white people stared when she came to get me. The soft white woman and the tall gangly teenager the color of scattered ash, she called her son. I remember the wide avenues and the flowering jacaranda trees in a blooming explosion of purple. She bought me Kentucky Fried Chicken and I ate it on the veranda, overlooking the city that hid beyond the wall and the gate. It was just before the referendum, when white people voted on giving black people the right to vote. The skies were clear, the African sun was hot on my young face, and the wild scent of earth, of renewal, was in everything. All the stop signs had FW sprayed on them. Stop FW. Stop de Klerk. Eugene Terblanche was king. I watched the Boer Nation on TV. Eugene, big and red-faced, a barrel of beer, full of righteous white Christian indignation. Eugene and his boys. I watched the bombs flower over Johannesburg in brilliant reds and yellows. Fire and blood. Eugene and his boys valiantly rode to battle with pipe bombs and guns, and I watched it on television. I felt like I was locked up, bound within the confines of the house, the garden, the walls, the barbed wire. I wrote, "The sun. The scent of carnations in the yard, fresh-cut grass, a whiskey decanter, and the even pt, pt, pt sound of the electric fence, like a memory of freedom." I wrote bad poetry and read cyberpunk. After a while, I didn't care about the problems. I was in love. I met Olelwa. In Xhosa, her name means child of peace. I keep her name inside me like broken glass. I was in love, with a country I hadn't seen since being a boy, and with a girl who was like me, a composite of opposites, who I met at a party my mother gave, who kissed me under a large African moon and let me hold her hand. On April 27, 1994, she was going back to New York to study. I went with her to the airport, but Eugene and his boys had been busy. The car bomb didn't kill her, only blinded her and tore out her arm, scarred her back and her legs and broke her soul. I crouched beside her, looking everywhere, not knowing what to do, how to help her, how to help myself. Her blood was on my hands, on my face, on my World Peace t-shirt. And I realized something then, that blood is the life, and that blood was what they fed on, the Afrikaner Weerstandsbeweging. And that, like Onla Mentse Bernstein Medjatso in the Bobuto Tswana coup, I too would pull the trigger if only I could. I too would end them. Do you remember the Bobuto Tswana coup? We're going to reenact it. No more poetry. Kwaito music spills out onto the pavement. Wes and I march up Main Street. A Rasta man glances up at us, begins to offer us dope, changes his mind. This is the new South Africa, the Rainbow Nation, the land of Nkosi Sikelele, Africa. In the bars we pass, white and black kids are dancing together, getting drunk on Castle Lager and Vintuken Zambezi beer from across the border in Zimbabwe. Upmarket drinks for upmarket kids. The middle classes always win. Wes checks out the girls. Indian girls and white girls and black girls and Chinese girls and the beautiful cocoa and cream girls from Mozambique. I look at him sideways and say, "You're too old for them." And Wes grimaces and lights up a Marlboro. He says, "Fuck you, bro. I'm not old, I'm experienced." And I laugh. On the left is a cocktail lounge piping out reggae. I see Lufuno, jerk my head at Wes, who follows my gaze and nods once. She's sitting with a drink by her elbow, keeping company to a pack of Malawian Life cigarettes. Lufuno stands up when she sees us. Her smile is a sun. We approach her and sit down. "Yo," Wes says. I say, "Peace," and we touch fists. A big black man comes into the bar then, and as he goes past, he nods at Lufuno. I recognize him. His name's Dayo, and he's Nigerian. He runs drugs down in Hillbrow. He disappears into the back room. Lufuno sure knows some interesting people. Americans might say colorful, but they wouldn't, not to Dayo's face. From what I hear, he has no sense of humor. He's killed more people than I had therapy sessions. Are they here? I ask. Lufuno nods. Mingling with their dancers and their drinkers they are, she says. The white children of the night. She takes a final sip from her glass and rises, pocketing the cigarettes. She has a scar just visible on her right hand. And though I can't see it, I know that under the long sleeve, the scar extends all the way to her shoulder and continues down her back. Shall we do it? Yeah, Wes says. Let's kill the bloodsuckers. We walk out onto the street and start moving slowly up the road, weaving in and out of the bars and clubs in our search. They were vampires. I realized it that day at the airport, which was once Jan Smuts and is now Joburg International. Names change, and sometimes people too, but the Afrikaner Weerstandsbeweging, the Boer Nation, AWB, they never changed. They lived in the blood of others, have done so for hundreds of years, and when their food finally rebelled against them, they rode into town shooting. Remember Bobuta Tswana? On March 4, 1994, just a month before they blew up the airport, the AWB came to Bobuta Tswana, the puppet state in the north created by the apartheid government. They came riding into Mobatu, the capital, in a long convoy of buckies and Mercedes cars. They came armed with guns and grenades, and where they passed, they shot out of the windows of their expensive cars and tossed the grenades, and wounded and maimed and killed. They came to help Lucas Mangope, the black dictator of Bobuta Tswana, but even Mangope's own people revolted against them, and the Boer nation found itself under attack. Belatedly, they tried to retreat. Three AWB members, Nick Fourie, Alwyn Wolfart, and Farnie Haynes, driving their Mercedes at the back of a convoy, exchanged fire with black police. They were hit, and their vehicle came to a halt. Wounded, they demanded medical help. Onlametse Bernstein Menyatso, a policeman, was one of the men shooting at the convoy. He approached the wounded men. A foreign reporter filmed the whole thing on his camera. He said, "What are you doing in my country?" And then he shot them. It's an unmemorable place, made memorable by the twisting of a broken car on dark asphalt. A wounded blue metalled body, lying in the rain, in a dark blood road, soaked by an eternity of green. Minyatso, I came to realize, was one of us. He was a vampire killer. He realized the true nature of the men, and had acted upon it. No one remembers Bobuta Tswana, and the vampires still walk, free. We split up in our search. The room I'm in is dark and crowded, the music a rising beat that shakes the floor. I walk through the dancers. I am bait. I think of Tolelwa, of her large dark eyes looking into mine. She's married now, and living with her lawyer husband in Cape Town. They both worked for the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, hearing testimonies, granting amnesty. She moved on. But I am not reconciled. My walkie-talkie crackles. Anything? I say, no. There is a pause, a crackle of static. Lufuno says they're not here, but they are coming. Meet me in the street? I say, okay. We meet in the street. You said they were already here. Lufuno shrugs. So fucking sue me. She looks pissed off. I rethink my reply, then lose it as I see them. Two buckies off-white, mud-spattered, farm vehicles. They park at the bottom of Main Street. Loud Afrikaans music spills out of open windows. They come out, white skin browned by the sun, the blood of a dark continent pumping through their veins. They are big and healthy, and their leader is a big fat bull, a younger Eugene Terblanche. They walk up Main Street, and we three, Lufuno and Wesley and me, stand in their way. Their leader halts, and the rest follow. They fan around in a semicircle that confronts us. The leader looks at us, at me, and grins, revealing sharp white teeth. He says,
"How's it, Brew?"
I nod. My hand is inside my coat.
"Mind if we pass through?"
I nod again. The leader loses his grin.
"You got a problem with us, Brew?"
The butt of the gun is comforting against my hand. One of his coterie spits on the ground. His spit is dark and thick.
"Shit, Dancy, just push him out of the way."
The leader turns cold eyes on the speaker, who shuffles back into his place in the formation.
"Shut up, Koos."
"You should moor the fucker,"
Koos mumbles defiant.
"I'll moor you in a minute, Koos."
Silence. The leader looks up at each of us in turn. His smile returns when he sees Lufuno. He grins at her, exposing those long, sharp teeth.
"Why are you hanging out with these two moffies?" he says. "You should come with us. We're going to party up here and have a jol."
Lufuno is silent. Her face is a mask etched with the acid of old abuse. The leader looks at Wes, looks at me. His smile does not reach his eyes. He nods once, as if reaching a decision. He says,
"Get the fuck out of my way, gaffers."
The other one, Koos, grins at this and says,
"Ja, futsek."
Then everything happens fast and slow. The Uzi is out of my coat and firing. The spent cartridges make the sound of a winning slot machine as they hit the pavement. Beside me, Wes and Lufuno are firing with rapt, intense expressions. The leader ducks behind a blue Toyota Corolla and returns fire. He is furious. I lob a grenade at him and watch the car's window explode into 1,000 tiny rainbows. Then someone shoots out the streetlights and it's dark. Everything happens slow and fast. Tracer bullets like fireflies speeding through the night. The leader shouting,
"Charles, Rake, Pete, get in the buggy!"
Koos lying on the ground gurgling blood. The sound of a car engine starting. Headlights cutting through the darkness like the sun through the shaft of a mine. Bullets hitting metal. Someone screaming. The sound of an engine revving, abruptly cutting off. Wheels screech and die. I release the trigger and my body thrums with music. On the ground, three of the vampires still live. They crawl out of their car and lie with their backs against the punctured metal. They're bleeding. I motion to Wes and Lufuno, and they scan the area. Apart from the three in the car, the only survivor is the leader. Lufuno and Wes drag him from behind the blue Toyota. He leaves a snail's wet red trail in his wake. They prop him up against the car and step back. From the black bag over his shoulder, Wes takes out the video camera. He points it and gives me the thumbs up, but already he wears the detached, professional face of the media.
"Help us. Can't you see we need medical attention? Take us to a hospital."
I look at their faces, dark now with blood, terrified, hurting, and when I raise my head I seem to see Kolelwa standing above them, blind eyes looking directly into mine, one hand holding scales, the other a sword. She looks into my eyes. She shakes her head. "No." And then she's gone, like a stealing tokolosh in the night. They bleed other people's blood. The leader looks up at me. He doesn't beg. I look at his boy's face and I think of Eugene Terblanche. Even Eugene's reformed now, they say. Writes poetry and preaches on Sundays. Everyone's a born again in the new South Africa.
"Help us."
I pull the trigger.
Some of this story is actually true. In 1990, F.W. de Klerk began the process that would eventually disassemble the apartheid regime and, amongst other things, see Nelson Mandela released from prison. Unsurprisingly, this process led to an increase in support for the far-right parties, amongst them the AWB, fronted by Eugene Terblanche. Blanche was, and is, the worst kind of absurd, a deluded paramilitary whose world and worldview are memorably captured in two of Nick Broomfield's best films, The Leader, His Driver, and The Driver's Wife, and His Big White Self. Broomfield's a frankly incredible filmmaker, and if you wanted an introduction to how he does things, these two films, along with Tracking Down Maggie, are essential. Terre Blanche's lunacy peaked, as described here, with the invasion of Bafat at Tswana. Under his leadership, the AWB effectively squatted in the region, and the crimes they committed were unbelievable. The horrific violence that ensued led to at least 37 deaths, and the incident described here, with the AWB convoy firing indiscriminately at passers-by, and the point-blank murder of three wounded AWB soldiers by Onklemetsi Bernstein Meyatso, a local policeman. Meyatso was granted amnesty by the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, despite being cross-examined by Terre Blanche himself. AWB soldiers had fired indiscriminately into passers-by. This is fact. It's supported by the journalist present at the time, and Meyatso mentioned finding a young mother wounded in the attack as affecting him deeply. Terre Blanche, for his part, served a prison sentence, claims to be a born-again Christian, and recently reactivated the AWB, citing popular support. The AWB youth wing launched recently. He is its founding member. That, for me, is half the horror. But events like this can take place, and the man responsible for fostering such hate, for causing such incredible trauma, can get a book deal and be rehabilitated. The other half comes from the mindset of the lead character. The idea that there are some things you can never get over, never get past, that some breaks never mend, some wounds never heal, and all you can do is work around them, terrifies me. Because that's a more telling, more complete theft even than the taking of a life, the taking of principles, the maiming of a future, the murder of hope. Yet in amongst all that, there's the story of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, which is extraordinary. Its mandate was to bear witness to, record, and in some cases grant amnesty to the perpetrators of crimes relating to human rights violations, reparation, and rehabilitation. In essence, it took a long, hard look at the events of the apartheid regime, tried to understand them, and move on. It's a staggering, inspiring, brave idea, and the fact that both Meyatso and Terre Blanche were granted amnesty shows you how wide-ranging it was. Whether or not you agree with their findings is a different matter, but in terms of sheer courage, an organisation like the TRC is in a league of its own. Please take the time to do some reading about them, by the way. It's an inspirational and, at times, horrific story, but it's one that you need to know. And before I set you any more homework, I'll be on my way. Please consider donating to help us pay our authors, if you can. The link is at pseudopod.org under Feed the Pod, and whilst I know it's an expensive time of year, I also know how grateful we are for each and every donation. Pseudopod is a production of Escape Artists Incorporated and is released under a Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivatives license. And Pseudopod will always be digging in the dirt.